Song is Deeper Still from Ronnie Freeman. At 15 and a half after the hour, it's Wednesday morning, and so we greet Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug coming to us from Columbia, Maryland, right next door to Washington, D.C., which was just a buzz yesterday with hearings right and left. Doug, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I feel like I'm on the front lines here.
Well, you are. You are.
American issues these days.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I have the Washington Post before me.
Well,
the front section.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the last time they had a headline that went across the whole front page.
Oh, big.
Wow.
That big, huh?
Wow.
Okay.
A grim portrait of CIA tactics after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And then on the interior are five more pages of breakout detail.
Okay? Wow.
And you can read all five pages, and you probably would not understand that this was just written from a Democratic perspective.
Really?
On the committee.
Really?
No Republican involvement. It's as if this is the government's report.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. And the moral outrage that's being expressed. And then when I get to the bottom of page four, which I am now turning to, and this looks to be maybe a 3-inch column, Gruber apologizes at House hearing for glib words on healthcare politics.
No. Okay.
Now, I haven't done the arithmetic here, but I think torturing 37 foreign nationals who wanted to destroy America
Chop
is generating.
Oh, got you. Hit your button, Doug. Doug, we lost you.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Just as he was getting to the really good point.
Hit your button. Can you hear me, Doug? I wonder
I guess
if maybe
not.
He pulled his whole headphone out, maybe.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there you are.
Okay.
You are.
Where did I lose you?
Well, it was about 10 seconds ago.
You were 37 foreign nationals being who would be willing to chop our heads off.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a tremendous moral outrage about that.
Oh, yeah.
And no moral outrage at all over millions of Americans being waterboarded in a different manner when it comes to their health care.
Interesting, interesting look at things, yeah.
Now,
What did
Obamacare and the CIA torture report have in common? They both were written universally by Democrats.
Yeah, right.
No Republican involvement whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And
you know, it dawns on me that the same committee were writing up, say, the American Revolution, they would have dissed it because it didn't represent the majority of Americans.
Well, you know. If CNN and the cable news networks had been around for the invasion of World War II on the Normandy beaches,
D-Day, Operation
We would have had exposés on the incompetence of American military leadership left, right, and center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We would have done interviews with German soldiers who had been captured and imprisoned, and they were forced to keep their arms up for more than 15 minutes. Ah! That's a terrible, that's awful. Those guys ought to be brought up on charges. There's a, USA Today has got a letter from Bob Kerrey, the senator from Nebraska. He's not a senator anymore, but he was a Democrat. And he was on the Intelligence Committee. And his letter is just, that should take the place of everything that's on the front page of the Washington Post. And Kerrey said he didn't have to read it. Or didn't have to read the report to realize that all of it was written by Democrats and Democrat staffers, because the Republicans pulled out of it as soon as they realized that they were the Democrats that decided that the CIA was guilty. They just had to go out and prove it.
Hmm.
Well, even the Washington Post acknowledges that the 500-page executive summary is written in a, quote, prosecutorial tone, unquote.
Oh man, the parents of Michael Brown would be very proud.
But you know, and there's great outrage here that some within the CIA actually lied to Congress. Can you believe that?
Oh, And nobody cares that John Gruber sat up there lying his fanny off for 2 hours yesterday.
Well, let's just take the White House. Talk about lying to the
man,
American
people. Yeah, it just,
you can keep your health care. Your premiums are going to go down. The selective outrage here. Believe me, there's some outrage deserving of the torture. Don't misunderstand me. But it's the imbalance of the way two injustices are being entreated here. It's just amazing to me.
And it's also interesting that at the time, that is 2001, when the practice started right after 9/11, everybody was for it. Democrats could have pounced on this at that time and nixed the plan for the CIA interrogation measures, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was all fine then. Now it's a serious evil here. We've done ourselves
wrong.
Yeah,
and we've got all this revisionist history that, no, we really didn't know how bad it was.
See,
and
there's the real crime, is revisionist
history. I mean,
there's
nothing honorable about the torture, but there are really two injustices took place yesterday in Washington, D.C., the injustice over health care and the injustice over torture. And torture is getting 98% of the coverage in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And so the irony here, it's the injustice in the way two injustices are being treated.
It's just not just. One of the final things that former Senator Kerry writes in the aftermath, too, is he more or less says, in essence, what you just said. He said there's nothing honorable about torturing people and forcing them to tell us things. But he said, we were attacked and 3,000 people died in 2011. It hasn't happened since, or 2011. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't happened since.
Yeah.
We have not been attacked since. Something's happened. I mean, maybe.
And I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, maybe the enemy is defeated and they've given up and that's why they're not attacking. Or maybe we know something.
Yeah, and I think Gruber has done the American public a wonderful favor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
He is not stupid. He is the poster child of liberalism on steroids.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in mathematics, which I had to torturously take many, many decades ago.
The CIA program, apparently.
And calculus, when you do an integration, you integrate all the way out to what's known as the boundary condition. In other words, you push something as far as it can go. Mm-hmm. And I've always found that a useful way to analyze something. Push it, if something is good, push it out as far as it can go and see what you're dealing with. And if you want to see what liberalism unbounded looks like, it's Gruber.
Mm-hmm.
We know better. You, the rest of you are stupid. We'll make the calls. You deal with the consequences. We can see shades of that.
But just remember, it's for your own good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So.
No, if there is a good example of the condescending, super educated, but lack of intelligence individual, John Gruber is it. And if I had any friends that were sitting on the board of directors at MIT or alumni of MIT, I would certainly plant bugs in their ears. I mean, I wouldn't send my kid to there.
Yeah, well, like I say, he's not stupid, but what he is a narcissist without discernment.
Well, anyway, it's all about outrage.
To transition away from that.
What if we went back 2,000 years?
It is a fallen world, is it not?
Well, is it ever.
So we go back 2,000 years, and Caesar Augustus says, okay, we're going to do a census, guys. Now,
because it's a fallen world.
Because it's for your own good. We need to know this information. I'm trying to figure, what was the rationale for that particular census, and what was the reaction of the folks in Israel? Was this empire-wide, or was it just Israel, do you think, Doug?
That's an answerable question. It actually has a very reasonable answer to it, but let me, on a circular basis, get to that answer.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of a professor at North Carolina called Bart Ehrman?
Nope. Don't think so, no.
Nope,
I haven't. He's rather popular in the media these days. He's been voted the most popular professor on the campus at the University of North Carolina. And wherever, I got a block on where they're at, Chapel Hill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his stick is poking fun at Christianity.
Hmm.
And pointing out the errors in the Bible and the mythologies that exist in the Bible. And one of his assertions is, nowhere in history can we find any record that a census actually took place at the time Jesus was born. Okay? That's an assertion.
Mm-hmm.
Respond to that.
Well, the Romans kept records. You'd think there would be Roman records of such a census.
There were.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's, Josephus mentioned the census a number of times, a number of Roman records indicated census. I mean, they kept track. I think there must be all kinds of records.
Well, there used to be.
Ah.
But when the empire fell and the invaders burned all the Roman mm-hmm. records, mm-hmm. except for a small fragment that tells us about two census or censi. And it turns out that Rome did a census every 5 years for 700 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing exceptional about this census. It's just another one. Now, why does Rome do censi? Because it wants to figure out where are the higher growth communities, states in the Roman Empire, where they would divert more of their taxation monies for infrastructure improvements.
Yeah, they were big on central planning, weren't they?
They were.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you've got rapid growth in some areas, you better spend more tax money there to, A, show them you care, but also, you know, to make living conditions a little bit better with better infrastructure.
And also perhaps raise more tax money from those locations.
It isn't clear that you raise tax money by counting heads. You raise mm-hmm. tax money by taxing fish and grain and olive oil and crops and all that sort of thing. But I don't think there's a head tax per se that's mm-hmm. behind this census. They're simply trying to find out, where are all the people in the kingdom? Where are the fastest growth rates? Where should we be reallocating our investments? So, you know, there's nothing sinister behind this. It's just business as usual. So, to answer the Bart Ehrman assertion, the assertion is correct, but you cannot argue from silence when all the records have been burned, and you do get residual records that point out that census were taken every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, college students just buy the headline and think, oh, well, there's another mistake in the Bible. There's another error. Well, not at all.
But. Well, nothing like a smug professor to gather an audience on. I saw that when I went to school. So
yeah, well, Jonathan Gruber is probably the epitome of that, too.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I've got Bart Ehrman's Wikipedia page up, and you would think from what you just said, he might be maybe an economics professor, maybe ancient history, maybe world history, maybe specialist. He's a religious studies guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And but he doesn't know about
that. You know, being in religious studies is a far cry from meaning you also teach biblical truth.
Ah, okay.
So then the answer to my question would be that likely, yes, this was empire-wide, not just Israel.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's behind it here. Now, if you're going to do a Roman census, you know, I think without realizing it, we Westerners think in terms of election day. Well, everybody shows up and gets counted on one day, right?
Impossible.
Absolutely mm-hmm. impossible.
Hmm.
So would it surprise you to say that Rome allowed an 18-month window of time every 5 years to complete the census?
Actually, sounds pretty reasonable to me. I mean, people didn't have freeways, didn't have internet, didn't have telephones. They walked, they talked. It would take time to get information back to the census headquarters.
Well, and also in a culture where 90% of the people are agrarian and six people work all year long, almost 24/7, five people work year long, 24/7 mm-hmm. to feed six people, yeah. A very thin margin of error. You just can't up and go when it's harvest time or when it's planting season.
Mm-hmm.
or when maybe you're concerned about a crop infestation with something, all right? So you're going to pick the time that's best for you. And you're not going to do it when you have to commit yourself to the major festivals and the pilgrimages. You're not going to pick your time to go to for the census during bad weather, like winter, okay? So there's very logical rationale why there's an 18-month window of time to complete a census, because you want to maximize the participation and minimize the impediments, the barriers you put in people's way, to go back to, technical word here, the paterfamilias, the head of your clan. That's where you have to register. And so that raises yet another fascinating question. In a culture where 98% of the people are born and raised in the same village and never travel more than a mile away from home except to go to Jerusalem for major festivals, why in the world are Mary and Joseph, if they're of the Davidic clan, living 90 miles north in Nazareth?
Well, you know, when they came back from Egypt, they went back to Nazareth. That had to be home. I imagine that, is it fair to say, to assume that both were raised there?
Oh, yes, but that's the question behind the question. Why did their parents decide to live in Nazareth if the clan is in Bethlehem?
Well, that's a good question.
I remember Dr. James Martin telling me once, I think this is probably mid-90s, he was in Israel for a sustained period of time. He got invited to a wedding up in northern Israel in the Galilee district. And it was a town of 3,200 people, and 2,600 of them had the same last name.
Well, the clans.
Well, yeah. The point I'm making here is you live where your clan lives. Mm-hmm. Now, why in the world are the parents, or maybe it's the grandparents of Mary and Joseph, why in the world are they in the north if the clan is all set up in the south?
Work. They had to make a living.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just pause here for a moment. Have you ever pondered that question before?
Well, yeah. I mean, if Joseph was a craftsman or a carpenter, whatever that word meant that was used, he would have to go where the work was. I mean, he was not agricultural. Though I suppose it's possible he owned land in the home territory there around Bethlehem, the city of David, where his clan would have been based. But he had to find work as a carpenter. So, and I know that that up north in Gentile land there in the area of Galilee, there was a lot of construction going on. I'll bet that's where he went to work.
Actually, the Herod the Great was building massive projects all over the land. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to work on Herod's projects, being in Bethlehem, 5 miles south of Jerusalem, was not a bad place to be. So I don't think it's...
Well, maybe they were there because their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents were there. Maybe they were part of the group that came out of Babylon during the Hasmonean period, I suppose?
That's most likely the answer. But then the question behind that observation is, if you're in the exile waves in 130 BC, 125 BC, 120 BC, and you re-enter the land, why wouldn't you go straight south to Jerusalem, or in this case to Bethlehem, to set up shop again? Why would you go in the Galilee district?
Because when you lived in Babylon, you got soft. And life in the north was easier. The weather was gentler. There was green stuff around. You could grow things. It was more fertile ground, valleys and hillsides. Judah was largely semi-arid and arid.
That lifetimes. Is all true, which explains why 90%, if not more than that, are the Gentiles in the land are all living in the north. So that then raises the question again, why, when you return, would you not go live in the south where the vast majority of the people are Jews? Why would you choose to live where the majority of the people are Gentiles?
Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about this. Is this something to do with a prophecy?
Yes, it does. Uh-huh. Yep. Isaiah 9. Verses 1 and 2, a great light will shine, and it will be in Zebulun and Naphtali. Zebulun is where
now we got a little communications lock up here. Should bounce back momentarily. Nope. Okay. It was Skype that time that froze, I think.
Yeah, the prophecy is, and the rabbis have come to rule here, that Isaiah 1 and 2 means Messiah is first going to be seen in the north in the tribal allotments of Zebulun and Naphtali. Naphtali is where Capernaum is. That's where Jesus made his ministry base for the north. And Nazareth is in Zebulun. So if you're a Messianic Jew, you want to be where Messiah is going to be seen first.
You wanted to be where the action was, and in fact, they were.
They were, but it's bigger than that as well. If you get into Isaiah 61, verses 4, 5, and 6, you get actually the job description of why Jews would return from the exile in Babylon and go in the north, because you want to reclaim this part of the promised land for Judaism when Messiah comes. And the prophetic statement there is that, and when you read Isaiah 61, 4, 5, and 6, is that you, the Gentiles, will become your slaves. You will have their riches. You will be known as the ministers and prophets of God. And it's a very lofty prophecy. And that's why they're there. They've got to get the Gentiles out of this part of the country to make it ready for the return of Messiah. So when we read the Mishnah, the oral tradition of the Jews, that was codified and written down in 200 AD, we find out that in those returning waves in the 110 to 130 BC period of time was a clan named the Natsur clan. And they broke up and went into three different places. Part of them went to the Golan Heights and established a village. Part of them went to northern Galilee near Biram and established a village. And the remaining one set up a village overlooking a chalk ridge in southern Galilee. And that's where we think the name Nazareth, it's not an Old Testament site. We don't find any reference to Nazareth in the Old Testament. That Nazareth is a town for the Natsur tribe, the phonetic linguistic similarities there. And so all of this is simply background to say the people who live in Nazareth are Messianic zealots. And the irony of that is Messiah was raised in their midst and they missed it. Now, we still got a loose thread here.
Yeah.
Why are Mary and Joseph in Nazareth if the clan, the paterfamilias, is set up in Bethlehem because that's where they're going for the census? Well, we have to understand Herod the Great a little bit. He was a messianic, he had a God complex. He had a building megalomania complex. And he built one massive project after another, including a monument to himself named the Herodian, which is 3 miles east of Bethlehem. And when you stand on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, it's about a 6.5 mile view to the southeast. It's still, the foundation of that is still very prominent. And to elevate this monument called the Herodian that he was going to build for himself, Herod conscripted over 1,000 people from the greater Bethlehemite area for a multi-year project to move one hill and place it on top of an adjoining hill to make it twice as tall so that his monument for himself would be more prominent on the horizon skyline. Okay. And so because of the conscription of that project some 30 years before the birth of Jesus, Herod the Great is hated by Bethlehemite people. And then you've got the whole Temple Mount project going on as another building, epic building program by Herod the Great. It may well be that Joseph, as a tradesman, not a carpenter, as a tradesman primarily skilled in stone masonry, said, I am out of here because I do not want to work under the forced conscription of Herod the Great, like my ancestors have. I'm going to go to the north where Herod can't reach me.
Interesting theory.
Or, second hypothesis, Joseph's and Mary's family shared the vision that Messiah would be seen first in Zebulun and Naphtali, were messianic zealots as well, and decided they wanted to be up there because they were messianic zealots. So there's a second reason why we might find them
there. And there was a sense in the culture then that it was time for the Messiah, wasn't there? They were expectant.
Well, it's getting closer, let's put it that way. If you do some arithmetic, in 586 B.C., Babylon conquers the southern kingdom and takes the bright young men, the merchant class, the wealthier people, etc., to Babylon. And then we have Ezra and Nehemiah waves coming back in the 530s. And the temple is rededicated in 516 BC. So there's a 70-year differential between 586 and 516. And a number of Jews have seized on this 70-year interval such that when Rome conquered Israel in 63 BC, and Rome is viewed as the kingdom of evil, there was a growing movement that said, yes, but in 70 years, Rome will be gone.
A repeat of the Babylonian phenomenon.
Then. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And actually, the 70th year is going to be when Jesus is 12 years old. So remember Luke 2?
Winds up
He's
at
in the
temple.
In Jerusalem.
It was kind of his bar mitzvah, in a sense, wasn't it?
It was the year before his bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. And so the irony of that is Messiah had indeed come to the temple 70 years after the Roman invasion. Mm. It's just that nobody saw it for what it was. So if we back it up, they're now within 12 years of the 70th year interval. That'd be 58 years of the 70-year interval, the year that Jesus is born. But the closer you get to 70, the higher your expectations become that Messiah will return and there'll be another overthrow and Rome will be out of here. So that's all part of the contextual backdrop that goes into these first couple of verses here of Luke 2.
It's astounding. I've heard this said about archaeologists. There are archaeologists working all over the Holy Land and, well, all over the world for that matter. But there historically has been little communication between them. Now, there are all these elements in this Advent story as it's starting to form here that different people have access to, but it's almost like they're not talking to each other. We don't see that view from 30,000 feet and from 15,000 feet and from 5,000 feet to make sense of it all. This is such a rare treat, Doug.
Well, it's let's call this an integrated contextual approach
to the
text. There
you go. Good way to put it.
And you've identified probably the primary flaw in biblical studies these days is that there are 13 or 15 different aspects to biblical context. There are experts in each one of them, but they are often silos of competency, to use a phrase from business organizational life, that they don't talk to each other. So you can have a world-renowned archaeologist who really is not conversant at all in linguistic issues of the first century, and vice versa. And so you've got a lot of people who are researching, I'll call it ingredients to the cake, but very few people are actually taking all the ingredients together and integrating them and baking the cake. And that's what Preserving Bible Times likes to see. It's its role in life. We don't research the ingredients. We just try to stay abreast of it. Mm-hmm. But we try to be the cake bakers. And as we travel around the country on our various weekend teaching seminars, we teach pastors and parachurch people and lay people, small group leaders, how to be bakers of context to start to recognize and delve into like the issues that we were talking about this morning.
And this reminds me, too, of another point you've made in some of your monthly reflections, and that is that we grow and we learn as disciples in community. It's not like you can hole up in your den and open your Bible and read it until you pass out and understand the whole picture. There are parts to the story that you won't have access to without working in community with other brothers and sisters and with the knowledgeable pastors and educators within the Christian faith. Now, you can't do this on your own, in other words.
Well, that's one of the big presuppositions that's missed by Western individualistic thinking people, is that every time you enter the pages of the Bible, you enter the world of the community. The community always has a higher priority than the rights of the individual does. Mm-hmm. It's what's best for the community that matters. And that has become so inverted in our narcissistic Western culture. And yes, discipling does not take place in a Lone Rangerism climate. Mm-hmm. I think there was one thing that got missed in the Reformation of the solas. Sola Scriptura and Sola Fide and Sola Gratia are all wonderful, but we missed the sola of the priesthood of all believers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the great frontier that has yet to be rediscovered in Western evangelicalism. It is all about the community functioning together as the priesthood of all believers.
Yeah, and without getting into a long discussion on Martin Luther, that was his catchphrase, the priesthood of all believers, and yet he really ignored it in the way he changed the worship services.
You know, it was there in the earliest days of the Reformation, but mm-hmm. within 50 years, it was gone. Mm-hmm. It had just mm-hmm. faded away. Mm-hmm. It didn't stick. Mm-hmm. So I said that's the last Reformation that still remains to be energized, the mm-hmm. priesthood of all believers.
Yeah, I think that's key. Next week, I mean, we're just getting into the Advent story. Next week, we'll learn how Joseph and Mary... He gently put her on a donkey in Nazareth, and they took that long, lonely journey up the hill to Jerusalem, following the star, and went into the stable, and the three kings met him the next day, and
well,
gifts.
And then let me interrupt you and also
not right?
be a teaser for next week.
Oh, okay,
right?
Okay.
They didn't travel alone. Oh. And they didn't travel together.
But I'm looking
that would have
at
never happened.
But my Christmas
culture.
Card shows her on a donkey and a very
right.
Yeah.
Men and women always travel in separate caravans. You never travel alone. You travel in caravans because travel is dangerous. And because they're observant Jews, the men and the women can never travel together. So, yeah, that's hopefully that'll bring a few of your listeners back next week more context.
We'll learn some more about that. And the whole Advent story progresses here on The Broken Road next week. Doug, so much. Thank you so much again for joining us. And... Preserving Bible Times. I want to mention the website, preservingbibletimes.org. And there we go. You know, I started the music and it was nowhere to be heard. I got to do my disc jockey stuff here. Preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to it from our website. I recommend that you do, and further recommend you sign up for Doug's monthly reflection newsletter. You'll get it via email. Doesn't cost you a thing, and it will light up your day. I guarantee you. Doug, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Wednesday, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Shalom,
Doug.
Shalom.
Thank you very much.